From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actor Eli Wallach on the method, spaghetti westerns, Godfather 3, and how a Jewish actor became famous for his roles as Italians and Mexicans. Also today, cartoonists Drew and Josh Allen Friedman describe their bizarre gallery of washed-up actors, nightmare teachers, and grown men who sell comic books. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead introduces us to the music of Dutch bassist Martin Altena, and book critic John Leonard reviews Ken Kesey's The Further Inquiry, an account of his psychedelic bus trip across America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The congressional leadership is split over whether a special session of the Congress is needed to discuss military policy in the Persian Gulf. Republican leaders are urging the session to debate and authorize action against Iraq, but key Democrats say unless the president has given up on the use of economic sanctions, there's no reason to meet. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole and Republican Senator Richard Lugar urged President Bush today to summon Congress into a special session to lend support for military action against Iraq. Lugar said it should be done immediately to lay out specific U.S. goals in the Gulf. But Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said today such a meeting would serve no clear purpose.
Unless and until the president concludes and states that sanctions have failed, then it raises a question as to what is the basis for changing the military objective of American forces in the Persian Gulf.
When the president moves from the threat stage to the decision to actually use offensive military action in the Gulf, then Mitchell says it's time to look to Congress for the okay. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The chairman of two powerful Senate committees said they plan to hold hearings on the administration's shift to offensive capability in the Persian Gulf. Armed Services Chairman Sam Nunn and Foreign Relations Chair Claiborne Pell said they hope to begin sessions in several weeks. It's nighttime in Berlin, where once again there have been clashes between police and protesters occupying abandoned buildings. Hundreds of people have been injured in what's been called the worst street violence in the city in 10 years. Barbara Howard reports from Berlin.
For the second straight night, police and squatters are battling it out in eastern Berlin. Police have brought in armored cars and water cannons and have used tear gas to disperse the crowd, numbered in the hundreds. The police moved into the squatter neighborhood to reclaim a dozen abandoned tenement buildings where the squatters, mostly from western Berlin, started moving in a year ago when the Berlin Wall came down and housing prices in the west went up. The squatters met the police with barricades of old cars and trash containers and have thrown rocks and flares at the police. Demonstrations such as these are cited as one reason that the government in Bonn is reluctant to move the capital to Berlin. The squatters, self-proclaimed anarchists, rioted earlier on Unification Day, October 3rd. Then they were protesting unification, saying that with unification comes increased racism and nationalism. For National Public Radio, I'm Barbara Howard in Berlin.
Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street. Some analysts said activity was backing off in the face of a new rise in oil prices. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 5 points to close at 2,535.4. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eli Wallach is such a versatile actor. He's famous for his interpretation of Tennessee Williams and for his starring roles in Westerns. Williams gave Wallach one of his first big breaks, casting him in The Rose Tattoo. Wallach made his film debut in Baby Doll, which was also written by Williams. In 1960, Wallach was the heavy in The Magnificent Seven. He later played another heavy in a film of heavies, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. His other movies include The Misfits, The Lineup, The Victors, Girlfriends, and Movie Movie. Over the summer, he appeared in The Two Jakes, and next month you can see him in Godfather 3. Throughout his career, he's divided his time between stage and screen. He's currently touring with his wife, the actress Ann Jackson, in a production of A.R. Gurney's play Love Letters. This week, they perform at Philadelphia's Schubert Theater. Wallach was a charter member of the Actors Studio, where the actors practiced a technique that became known as the method.
All of it basically was an antidote from the cliché, from the conventional. You know, when an actor says, I remember, and he always looks up the sky, you think, what is he seeing up there? But that was a signal that he's remembering. And the method basically was to destroy all that and to get to the truth of a situation. So the studio was like a laboratory. We were professional actors in the theater, but we could go there and work out. I could go and do a scene from Hamlet with Millie Dunnick, for example. I'd do the closet scene. I wouldn't get to do that on Broadway. And I did it there.
Let's go back to the cliched way of I remember when, and the actor looks at the sky. If you had a scene where you were remembering something, what would you do differently to get into it? I mean,
well, I would actually try to remember. Although I know the next line. It says, it was that time of... Have you ever forgotten something and the person says, it's like having water in your ear. You go to sleep and it'll come out, the water will come out of your ear later. And you've heard people say, 10 minutes after they've tried to think of something, oh, and then they'll say, Palm Beach. That's what I look for, the true situation, not the cliché.
Yet there were clichés about actors who'd studied the method at the Actor's Studio, right? What was the cliché that you had to resist about actors from the Actor's Studio?
Well, there's a myth that all members of the studio mumbled. All members of the studio paid no attention to the other person. They were so involved in dredging up the truth of what they had that they paid no attention to the other person. Those are myths. We were impossible. We discovered a new religion, and we had no patience for other actors. I never forget taking Sir Laurence Olivier to the Actor's Studio, and he said, well, I can see you're nitpicking now, you know. And I said, well, you did it too. You have your way of working. Olivier, for example, gets into a character by putting on the externals. He puts on the nose and the robe and so on, and that's the way he gets it. Others say, which comes first? Do you find the truth of the situation? I've played all sorts of characters, bandits. I've played a lot of bandits. And one time I figured out, you always see them holding up the train or breaking into the bank. You never see what they do with the money. It's always the pursuit of it. I wanted to show the reverse side of the coin. I wanted to show the wealth this guy ostentatiously had. So I put on red silk shirts and gold teeth and silver saddles. And that's where the method helps, a kind of a technique that you work at to bring a character to life.
Was that the Magnificent Seven?
That was the Magnificent Seven, yeah.
My guess is Eli Wallach, since you've brought up how many bandits you've played, let me bring up a couple of films you've played them in. One was the Magnificent Seven, and you played the head of a band of Mexican outlaws,
right,
who raids a village and keeps this village under the outlaws' control. And the Magnificent Seven is a group of kind of renegade freelance fighters who save this Mexican village. How'd you get cast in that role? First of all, you were
know.
Mexican. In it.
I don't really know. I know that when I first read the script, I said, well, I want to play the crazy... It was based on the Seven Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play the crazy samurai. Oh, no, they said, that's the love interest. Horst Buchholz is going to play it. What do you want me to play? They said, the head bandit. I said, well, in the Japanese movie, you just see his horse's hoofs, and he's a man with an eye patch. I don't want to play that. Then I read the script carefully, and I come in right into town in the first minute of that movie, shoot somebody, and ride out. The next 50 minutes of that movie are devoted to me saying, is he coming back? When is he coming? I said, I'll do it. And I loved it. I used to arrive on the set early in the morning, put on my outfit, get on my horse with my 35 bandits, and we'd go for an hour ride through the brush in Tepoztlan in Mexico. And I loved it. I loved it.
Did you have to learn gunplay and horse riding for the role?
No. If it says I shoot somebody, I shoot them. I'll never forget what my son said. Yulbrunner shot and killed me in this movie. And my son was about 7, and he said to me, gee, Dad, couldn't you outdraw Yulbrunner? I said, Peter, when you read the script, you read whether you're shot or not shot. So I love those kind of films. They're fun.
Now, another famous Western that you did is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Right.
Now, this is the most celebrated of the spaghetti westerns.
Correct.
And the director, Sergio Leone, is now considered one of the great directors of our time. He was not known, though, when you worked with him on The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Did you think of him as a great or potentially great director then?
No, when I was making a film in California, when the agent out there said, there's an Italian here who wants you to be in a movie. I said, what kind of movie? He said, a Western. He said, a spaghetti Western. I said, that's an anomaly. That's like Hawaiian pizza. I don't know. He said, he wants you to look at a few minutes of one of his other movies. And I looked at a few minutes and I said, I'll do it. Where do you want me to go? He said, I want you in Rome on such and such a date. And I arrived. And I spent the next 4.5 months working every day on that movie. And it was an exhilarating experience.
Well, now, what had he seen of yours?
Evidently, The Magnificent Seven. So that, I don't know how, you never know how things happen in the movies.
Did it seem ironic to you that you and Clint Eastwood, who had played in American Westerns, were now making a Western for an Italian director?
Originally, all those Italians changed their names. Two of the biggest stars in Italy are Terence Hill and Bud Spencer. Their real names are Mario Girotti and Carlo Pedersoli. And they changed their names because no one wanted to go and see Italians playing Westerns. But I, after The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I spent about 6 years off and on in Italy doing Westerns.
You played a Mexican in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yep.
So once again, you had to do a Mexican accent. But it was a light one. It was kind of light,
yes.
Mexican accent. I want to play a short clip from the movie.
Oh.
Okay. And this is a scene. If anyone remembers the story, I'm sure a lot of our listeners do, you and Clint Eastwood have this scam going. There's a big price on your head.
Right.
So Clint Eastwood brings you into the law. And just as they're about to hang you, he cuts you loose and you both ride away and you split the bounty.
Exactly.
So you split the price that was on your head. So this is after the first time when you're about to be hung, Clint Eastwood frees you and you're splitting up the bounty.
Right.
There are two kinds of people in the world, my friend. Those with a rope around their neck and the people who have the job of doing the cutting. Listen, the neck at the end of the rope is mine. I run the risks. So the next time I want more than half.
You may run the risks, my friend, but I do the cutting. If we cut down my percentage. Cigar? Liable to interfere with my aim.
But if you miss, you had better miss very well. Whoever double-crosses me and leaves me alive, he understands nothing about Tuco. Nothing.
I love that little sadistic laugh at the end.
But I don't think it's a very good Mexican accent. It's standardized. It isn't. I didn't do the cliche of I think maybe I do la third. You know, I don't. I didn't do that. I wanted specifically to be clear in what I was saying.
So where did you get the accent from?
I went to school in Texas as a young man. I went to the University of Texas in the 30s. In my class were John Connolly, Walter Cronkite, Zachary Scott, and Elaine Steinbeck. And I used to ride horses down there, and I used to go to Mexico as often as I could. I loved Mexico. I think Mexico is a pure country. It's a good country. And so I picked up. Accents always frighten me, but I once played an Oriental on the stage in London, Tea House of the August Moon, and I was convinced that at some point in the play, some Japanese man would stand up in the audience and point at me and say, "Faker, that man is not an Oriental." See? And I get terrified that I'd get discovered.
In the Italian Westerns that you made, especially in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, everything's dubbed, right?
Right.
Afterwards?
Right.
So what language did you do it in initially?
Oh, I do it in English.
You do it in English.
But I've played with Italians, French, German. They play in their language. I play in mine.
So in these international casts, everybody's talking in their own language.
Exactly.
And it's dubbed in afterwards.
It's the Tower of Babel. It really is. But you wait until they stop speaking, or you know what the sense of what they're saying. But then you have to go in a studio and dub it. And I kept thinking of scenes on horseback riding through the desert. Now I am in a studio. I have to match the essence of what he's saying. It's not easy.
Why do they do it that way?
Because it's easier and cheaper. An airplane flies over, they don't stop a scene. They drop a wrench in the middle of a scene. It makes a noise. They don't care. Two other Italians over in a corner will be arguing about something. One director said to an Italian actor who's playing with me, he said to me, the Italian actor said, "I don't like Americans." I said, "Why?" He said, "I lost my arm in the war." I said, "Well, I don't know. What could I do?" He was not an actor. So the director said, "I want you to count from 1 to 10 angrily." So the man said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then when they dub it in, he's playing a wonderful scene, an angry actor. Well, that's movies.
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is really one of the most kind of brutal, sadistic westerns.
No, it's done with tongue in cheek.
I know. It is. I know there's a lot of humor in it. But what kind of mood did Leone, I'm never sure which it is, tell you that he wanted?
One of the things he said to me, he said, "I want every shot to be done like Vermeer. I want the light to come in from the side windows." And he said to me, "I don't want you to have your gun in a holster." I said, "Where will I put it?" He said, "With a lanyard around your neck." I said, "Oh, and then it dangles between my knees, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "When you want it, you twist your shoulders and I cut and the gun is in your hand." I said, "Show me." He put it around his neck. He twisted his shoulder. He missed the gun. It hit him in the groin. He said, "Keep it in your pocket." So that's
It's interesting that you became a kind of action hero when you were probably in your 50s already.
When The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly?
And The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
You must have been younger. In your 40s in The Magnificent Seven. But, you know, like today, most action heroes are a lot younger. It's like they start off in their 20s and 30s playing that kind of role. Yeah. Did you feel like it was an odd match?
Well, you wear very tight pants in these movies, and to get up on a horse, they'd always have to cut. I'd put my foot in the stirrup, but then they'd cut away to somebody looking at me, and the next thing I was on the horse. See? So, no, I tell you, in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I did most of the stunts, and they were very dangerous. I was sitting on a horse with a noose around my neck, and Clint's supposed to shoot the rope. Then they put a little charge of dynamite in the rope, and it would explode. And then I would ride off on this horse. I said, "Did you put any cotton in the horse's ears?" They said, "What do you mean, cotton in the horse's ears?" I said, "He can hear the explosion. He's going to be terrified. My hands are tied behind me." Well, they didn't do it. They shot the rope, and that horse took off. Now I'm riding, not using reins, just using my knees, and praying that that horse would eventually stop. And eventually he did, but it was frightening.
Oh, I'm really impressed because, I mean, that horse really takes off after the gun goes off.
Oh, yeah.
And I assumed there was some kind of trick there or something because I figured it would really need a stunt rider to ride that with their hands tied behind their back.
No, I rode, but you have to be very careful. Horses are not, you know, I just came from Lexington, Kentucky in the horse country. We did the play down there. And horses are not supposed to be too smart. Thoroughbreds are very frisky. They're angry most of the time.
Yeah.
The horses I get in America, in American films, are trained. They know how to hit their marks. They shift their weight. They look great. But when you get into a foreign movie and they bring out a horse, I say, "I want the gentlest, sweetest horse." And he usually turns around and looks at me when I sit on him and thinks, "Oh, God, I've got this guy for 3 weeks." You know? But I like riding.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is actor Eli Wallach, and he's now appearing in Philadelphia in the play Love Letters, and he's starring with his wife, Ann Jackson. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Eli Wallach. He's been in many plays and films over the years. His films include Baby Doll, The Magnificent Seven, The Misfits, and The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He recently appeared in The Two Jakes and will be in Godfather 3, which is scheduled to open this Christmas. He's currently in Philadelphia, starring with Ann Jackson in the play Love Letters. I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were describing how you learned how to ride a horse and how you learned a Mexican accent when you were at the University of Texas. I can't think of a lot of people from Brooklyn who went to Texas to go to college, and this must have been, what, the 1940s?
In the 30s.
In the 30s. What got you to Texas to go to college?
The tuition was $30 a year. The University of Texas was an oil-rich college, university. It's a huge plant now with 40, 50,000 students. When I went, it was 4,000 students. And I couldn't get into City College. I didn't have the grades. I never liked high school. And I finally wound up down in Texas. I'll never forget, after the first semester, I went back up to New York to make some money for my tuition. And I wore a big belt that said Tex, Texas on it. And they used to call me Tex. Here I was from Brooklyn. And so they assigned me as a horseback riding counselor. And so I had to ride. And that's one of the reasons I rode a lot.
When did you start acting?
As a boy, as a little boy. And before the war, I went into the neighborhood playhouse. I failed the teacher's exam. Everybody in my family were teachers. Thank God I failed it. And I went, got a scholarship to the neighborhood playhouse school of the theater. I'm on the board of that school now. It's a wonderful acting school. I finished, one of the teachers was Martha Graham, Sanford Meisner, and so on. I finished in 1940. And we did our senior project was a dance from Look Home with Angel. Tony Randall was in the class. We choreographed Look Home with Angel. And at one point, Uncle Sam stands on a thing and points a finger at me and says, Uncle Sam wants you. And sure enough, I got a low number in the draft, and Uncle Sam got me. So I went in the Army at the end of 1940 and got out at the end of 1945. So I spent 5 full years in the Army, not acting. I kept thinking, Broadway, here I come. And Uncle Sam kept saying, wait a minute, we've got problems here. So I spent 5 years as a medical administrator in the Army.
Eli Wallach is my guest. We'll be seeing you soon in Godfather 3. I haven't been keeping up with all the articles about it. What kind of role do you play in it?
I play a character called Don Altobello.
You're Italian again.
Yes, tall and handsome. Don Altobello, an old, old friend of the Corleone family. So I said to Coppola, the director, if I'm such an old, old friend of the family, why wasn't I in Godfather 1 and Godfather 2? He says, well, you were away in Sicily. And it was very sweet. The second day I was going to work on this movie, he said to me, you're going to play it all in Sicilian. I said, no, I don't know Sicilian. He said, well, get a guy, you get a cassette, you'll memorize it. So I memorized it, and there'll be subtitles under that scene, that specific scene. I play, it sounds like this. E che bello vita stare qua. Like that.
Had you seen The Godfathers 1 and 2?
Oh, yes.
So you felt you could just pick up on the story?
Well, no. When I got the script, the last 10 pages were omitted.
Why?
Because he didn't want anybody to know their fate in this movie.
Oh, like Woody Allen.
Oh, you had no idea where I was going. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. And it's very interesting not to know. It's like life. You don't know when you're going to pop off, right? And he was a fascinating director because he would stimulate. He'd tighten a screw here and tighten a screw there with just a word or two. And he'd leave me alone pretty much. I played an old man. With an hour and 20 minutes of these rubberized makeup thing on. Now, to go from Cinecittà in Rome back to my hotel at the Spanish Steps would take an hour by car. So I rode the subway. So the first day I finished, I got on the subway, which was 20 minutes, very fast, and I'm sitting there looking at my script, and I'm peeling off all this rubberized makeup. And I look up, and there, the opposite side of the car of the subway, they're all staring at me. Half my chin was off with this rubberized, and I put it back on and they applauded. That's Italy.
Did they realize you were an actor? Did they think something very grotesque was happening?
They knew I was coming from Cinecittà, so they know all the actors come out of that studio.
Oh, I see. I see. You're currently in Philadelphia performing in A.R. Gurney's play Love Letters, and you're performing with your wife, Ann Jackson. I know this is a play that you're very fond of. Tell us something about it.
Well, what's fascinating about this is every actor in America wants to do this play. And it's being done by a great number of actors. E.G. Marshall is doing it with Colleen Dewhurst. Matthew Broderick is doing it with some young actress. In England, it's being done by Robert Wagner and Stephanie Powers. It's being done all over the United States and all over the world. It's two people sitting there reading letters to one another from about age 6 to their late 50s. And an audience becomes hooked into this correspondence and what happens to these two people. And they all identify with it. They remember their first kiss, their first date, going dancing, your first affair. All of that is taken in, and it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to hear an audience respond to that.
Have you been able to work with your wife, Ann Jackson, much in theater?
Yeah.
And how do these opportunities present themselves?
I think it saved the marriage, and it saved psychiatry bills and marriage counselors, because we tend to get plays to do which have great fights in them, and we air out all our grievances theatrically. She and I have been acting together over 40 years now, and we really, I enjoy it. I enjoy acting with her. So we're going to do a new play in New Jersey in this next year.
So how does fighting on stage prevent you from fighting at home?
Oh, no, we do fight at home, but it's in the middle of a fight, I think, oh, God, my voice is open, it's clear.
This is good.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. And then I always try to think of her side of the situation. One thing actors have to do is really listen to the other person. In a fight, your emotions tend to cloud up all the listening process. Well, as an actor, I always try to listen to what she's saying, to try to get through to what her complaint is, and I think that helps.
You've, throughout your career, divided your time between theater and movies. Have you had a preference? What kind of balance have you wanted to keep?
Well, I've got the appetite still to act. I love to act, and I don't care where it is. It could be in a tiny theater in Chicago, or it can be on a huge stage in New York, or a movie in the middle of the jungle in Cambodia. The fact is that I'm acting in each one of those media, in the media. But if given a choice, if I were told by a judge, you can only practice one of television, movies, or the theater, I'd choose the theater without hesitation.
Why?
Because the gratification is immediate. There's a connection between me and an audience. I have control over what you see. In a movie, you only see what's put on the screen. I did that movie, The Two Jakes, with Jack Nicholson. When they cut it and edited it, I had a long scene in a courtroom that was cut out. Now no one knows about that. In The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, there's 20 minutes of me tracking down Clint Eastwood in a cave. It's beautiful, brilliantly shot. No one has ever seen it. So I don't like that. I like to have control over what you see.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
A pleasure, truly.
My guest has been Eli Wallach, and he'll be in Godfather 3, which is scheduled to open next month. And now he's performing the A.R. Gurney play Love Letters in Philadelphia with his wife, the actress Ann Jackson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by Martin Altena, a Dutch bassist whose music is influenced by such 20th century composers as Igor Stravinsky and Morton Feldman. Also, a talk with Drew and Josh Allen Friedman, the creators of such comics as I, Joey Heatherton, Hollywood's Wildest Love Duos, and The Entertainment Freak. And John Leonard reviews Ken Kesey's new book about his days on the bus with the pranksters. It's called The Further Inquiry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There are calls in Congress for a special session of Congress to consider the U.S. buildup in the Persian Gulf. But the White House today calls such a move not necessary. While Senate Democratic Leader George Mitchell said a special session was necessary only if the president decides to go to war against Iraq, Mitchell did say that Senate hearings will be scheduled in the Gulf crisis, probably over the next several weeks, because he says the American people deserve a full national debate. In Israel, according to police and military officials, an army reservist has been killed by an infiltrator from Jordan. This is the second infiltration in less than a week. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The clash occurred early this morning near Jericho. An Arab man, dressed in civilian clothes but carrying a pistol and a knife, shot and killed an Israeli reserve soldier. The gunman was captured. The infiltration, the second in a week, has raised new questions about the stability of Israel's border with Jordan. Last week, five armed men infiltrated and killed another Israeli soldier. Israeli analysts fear that Jordanian King Hussein is losing control over his army and over the border. Meanwhile, the spokesman for the outlawed Kach party, connected to slain Jewish extremist Meir Kahana, was arrested today after he was seen walking through Jerusalem's old city with a machine gun. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
In Miami, former Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega could be represented in his trial on drug trafficking charges by court-appointed attorneys. Jeff White reports that the problem involves attorneys' fees.
U.S. District Judge William Hoover said during a hearing in Miami today that he will appoint two government-paid lawyers for Noriega, who will receive about $60 an hour if the payment problems with his present attorneys are not resolved by the end of this week. Noriega's lawyers say they haven't been able to prepare the general's defense because all of his money is frozen in European bank accounts pending drug trafficking investigations. 5 months ago, Judge Hoover told U.S. prosecutors to get some of the European funds unfrozen so Noriega could pay his attorneys, who are asking for over $300 an hour. But a Justice Department lawyer told the judge today that the European governments have so far refused to cooperate. Judge Hoover had set a trial date of January 28th, but he said today that it will have to be delayed somewhat. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
The strongest storm to hit the Philippines this year has killed at least five people and sunk 17 ships. Typhoon Mike and its winds of up to 125 miles an hour also forced thousands of people out of their homes in low-lying areas. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 5 points to close at 2,535.40 on volume of some 160 million shares. Trading today was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Leonard reviews Ken Kesey's new book later on the show. Dutch bassist Martin Altena comes from a family of classical string players, but he's taken a different musical route. In the 1970s, he was active in the free improvisation movement, playing solo concerts and participating in one-time ensembles. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, more recently, Alton has been playing music that mixes improvisation and composition with the music he heard early on.
When jazz critics write about Martin Altena these days, they mention folks you don't often hear about in jazz circles, composers like Morton Feldman and Earl Brown, and especially Igor Stravinsky. Just as early New Orleans jazz musicians built on the brass band tradition they were familiar with, Martin Altena has been influenced by the sounds of his people, European classical musicians. Bill Shoemaker has pointed out how much Altena's current octet music resembles Stravinsky's 1918 suite for septet, The Soldier's Tale. Here's a little of that. Martin Altena's chamber ensemble has a similar instrumentation to Stravinsky's. Both have two reeds, two brass, violin, bass, and percussion. And Altena's music has the same transparent textures and colors, the same springy dance rhythms and quick transitions. That's part of the title track of the album Riff, one of two recent Altena CDs on the Hat Art label. The other one, released a year ago, is called Quotal. We've been listening to music from both. They're two of the most interesting albums to come from the European vanguard in a while. Few musicians from the continent manage such a deft balance of the compositional savvy that's at the heart of European art music with the self-expressive leeway of jazz. That's tenor saxophonist Peter Van Bergen on Martin Altena's composition, Boa. Altena knows when to let his players cut loose and when to rein them in, but he mixes the structured and open sections in ways you may not expect. For instance, on the title track from Quotal, the quietly restrained parts sound improvised and the raucous loud stuff sounds written. It's curious that Martin Altena should be so influenced by music Stravinsky wrote in 1918. That was just before American jazz musicians began invading Europe and catching the ears of composers there. Altena's writing doesn't sound much like American jazz, and there are conservatives in the States and avant-gardists in Europe who'd insist that music like this isn't jazz at all. I'd argue that it is, partly on the strength of the improvised parts and the vocal quality of the instruments. This music couldn't exist without jazz as one of its models. But I'd lump this European music in with American jazz mostly because it has nothing to gain by being divorced from jazz. Swinging rhythm and blues feeling never hurt anybody. Finally, though, what you call it doesn't make much difference. As Duke Ellington liked to say, and as critics like to repeat, there are only two kinds of music, good and bad. This stuff sounds real good to me.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Martin Altena's recording Riff and Quotal on the Hat Art label. This is Fresh Air. It's unusual to find a glossary in the back of a book of comics, but since cartoonist Drew and Josh Allen Friedman are fascinated by some pretty obscure has-beens of popular culture, you need a glossary to figure out who they've targeted in their new book, Warts and All. People like Tor Johnson, the giant Swedish ex-wrestler who achieved movie infamy in cheap horror films. Drew draws, and Josh's brother writes the stories for most of the cartoons. Drew's cartoon style can best be described as exaggerated realism. And Josh's stories are caustic and witty. Drew's work also appears in Spy Magazine and Raw. He also designed a new, purposely disgusting candy called the Barfo Family. In their new book, there's one strip called I, Joey Heatherton. The story is written by Josh.
I've always had a fascination with certain types of showbiz characters like Frank Sinatra Jr. or Wayne Newton or Joey Heatherton, and For years, I kept the file on every clipping I saw about Joey. I tried to interview her once or twice, and she would turn me down. And about 4 years ago, all of a sudden, she started making post headlines when she just disappeared with two suitcases. She went on the run, and she was in all sorts of trouble. And she had they had a Dear Joey column on the cover of the New York Post for a week. And that just was the last straw. I had to write turn that into a comic strip, and I researched her entire life. And in a sense, some of the characters we do, it's almost like we get to make a movie using anybody we want without being in the movie business. We do it through a cartoon strip instead because nobody wants to do cartoons and everyone in the world wants to do movies. So we could, if we wanted to star Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet in our own movie, we would just do a comic strip about them.
Now, in addition to paying tribute to B-movie actors, you also make up characters like Marnon Charnin, who gets a job at age 30 as a carpet store salesman because his bar mitzvah funds have been depleted, and he channels his sexual frustrations into becoming the greatest carpet salesman in America. Josh, was this based on someone you know?
This Marnon is an original character, although in actuality he also is an actual person, and it's based on every second of that is an actual experience with Marnon, who's just the guy we kind of knew when we grew up, a friend of ours.
Now he's buying the original artwork off us.
Oh, really? And saying, hey, this is about me?
Yeah. Well, he's come into some money lately, and now all of a sudden he's buying the original art and hanging up in his home. And
he went from total poverty into a little landfall. Now he's bought some of his comic strips. And again, if you can do a comic strip about Marnon, you could probably do it about anybody in the world.
Are you suggesting that's how uninteresting he is?
Well, Marnon is basically a guy who spends a lot of time watching TV and buying comic books, and you know, but we still feel we should pay tribute to the man for his achievements.
How did you start working together?
I think the way it started, Drew for many years had been drawing on his desk in school, drawing his teachers naked, getting into trouble with drawing. He drew very ugly people for many years, and teachers were recommending he be sent to, you know, be looked at by a shrink or something. But my response to that was to try and channel it into something. So in the late 1970s, I just wrote a script. I said, Drew, you just got to do something with this instead of just, you know, it was almost like a guerrilla artwork that he was doing. So the first strip we did was called The Andy Griffith Show. And it was just a means to get Drew to do something with his art.
So Drew, when Josh started drawing stories for you to illustrate, you know, to draw comics around, was that a revelation for you that you could channel this into something?
Yeah, at that point in the late 70s, I was sort of kind of, I wasn't centered on any particular thing. And all of a sudden it hit us, why don't we just start doing some comic strips our way? And we had several ideas. One of them was, what if Fred Mertz became pregnant? We didn't go in that direction, but we did
the actual thing that instigated, we imagined, what if Fred Mertz put a Q-tip in his ear and cleaned his ear, right. And that was the trigger to whole comic strip.
That launched everything. And we turned him into and he was the landlord of that building they used in I Love Lucy, so we sort of turned him into a slumlord. And
arsonist, which was appropriate at the time to do it.
Yeah, this was the early period.
Drew, your drawings are really incredible. They're like super real drawings.
Right.
And every detail on the face is there and almost enlarged. I mean, there's more, warts and all.
Warts and all.
But there's more details in your drawings than there are in most photographs. Photographs seem airbrushed by comparison to your drawings.
Mm.
Do you work off of photographs? Do you copy photographs?
I do.
When it's based on real people?
I do use a lot of photo reference when it's based on real people. And that's I do it for several reasons. One, I want it to disturb people for people to really think that this possibly could have happened, or this actually could have taken place. I want it really to have a photorealistic look to it, a documentary type look that just kind of is disturbing to people. But when I use photos, I try to exaggerate just ever so slightly, because I'm not a caricaturist, and I want to keep it as realistic as possible, but just make it, just a little bit weirder and hopefully a little disturbing. And that's the effect that we get.
Drew, you have an incredible eye for faces. And a lot of the faces that seem to interest you in the original drawings are faces that are really grotesque.
Mm.
Like, for instance, there's a strip in Warts and All called Comic Shop Clerks of America, Grown Men Who Sell Comic Books. And they're all like monstrous looking. They all have warts on their faces. They're missing teeth. They're balding in unusual patterns. They have saliva strings between their teeth when they open their mouths.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why you're so absorbed in really ugly faces.
Oh, aside from the comic strips, which I want to be interesting and pretty, I suppose. I mean, it's kind of attractive artwork. I also find attractiveness in, like you say, disgusting, ugly, horrible-looking faces. It's just nothing that pleasures me more than being hunched over my desk, stippling in warts and
double chins.
Double chins. I'm also, I think I'm also the master of liver spots.
Yes.
My editor at Spy Magazine brings that up every time I bring in a new drawing. He says, Drew, you better tone down those liver spots. So. It's just I just really enjoy getting into the crevices of a horrible looking face. And to me, it's not the faces aren't horrible. I find beauty in, I suppose I find beauty in a certain kind of ugliness. And there's nothing more attractive to me than
an elevator man.
A horrible looking
New York doorman or elevator man is a real beauty to us.
Yeah.
As a study.
Let's get to one of the more personal strips, The Nightmare Gallery of Mentally Disturbed Teachers. Are the people in this strip really taken from teachers that you had?
Yeah, those are all actual teachers of mine, and Drew was 2 years behind me in school, so he had some of them too, luckily, because we'd had no pictures for references. We're talking 20 years back where we went to school. I always felt that the teachers at my school, at my public school in Long Island, were 9 out of 10 of them were officially disturbed people. There's no question that they had a very bad influence on kids. They were very destructive to me. And
tell us about one of the real destructive ones. One of the ones that was really destructive to you.
Well, my fifth grade teacher was a middle-aged man who used to scream at the class, and he hated most of the kids. He hated his job. He was a chain smoker. And he drank 20 cups of coffee a day. He had dandruff. And I just remember standing before his desk totally confused with the math that we were learning and never taking the time to be patient and explain it to me, just yelling at me and smacking a ruler to go back and do it again. And it was a miserable year. So he just gets one panel in our strip. And Drew, from memory from 20 years ago, actually drew these teachers the way they looked.
Your father is the humorist Bruce J. Friedman, and he wrote the book The Lonely Guy. He wrote the screenplay for Splash. Did you grow up with a lot of humorists, and did humor seem like a feasible way to actually make a living?
Yeah, it did to us. It was just like the insurance business to us. And secondly, humor never seemed funny to us. And anything that we do that might go under the category of humor, we don't see as really funny. We're not like, yeah. We don't think of ourselves as being funny, or we don't think of the strips as funny.
When I see this book in the humor section in bookstores, I'm just kind of confused about it.
Why?
Well, to me, the humor section of a bookstore is always the least funniest section. I don't derive humor from Mad Magazine or National Lampoon. To me, the Christian Science Monitor is a funny publication, and there's nothing funnier than People Magazine. And
Reader's Digest is funny. And
mm-hmm.
A lot of people who grew up to work on comics had their comics confiscated by parents when they were young. Since your father was a humorist himself, did you not ever have that problem?
We had almost the reverse problem. We were forced to look at Playboy when we were a kid because our father had stories in there all the time. And we had a housekeeper once who used to caught me with Playboy, and she grabbed it away from me, and she said, "How dare you? I'm telling your father." And I said, "But my dad's in it." So there was really no way we could get punished for that. Mad Magazine was our favorite childhood magazine. It would be taken away in school and ripped up, but not at home.
And our dad worked at the company that did Marvel Comics in the early 60s.
They had a little office over in the corner at this place called Magazine Management, where he edited some men's magazines, where they gave a little corner to a guy named Stan Lee, who created Marvels there. So I used to get number one of everything when I was 6 years old. I didn't know what they were, and I threw them out.
He'd bring home piles of comic books from the office every day, so it was really forced down our throats.
Freshly minted Marvel comics, but we never liked Marvel at all.
Why not?
The superhero stuff, even then, we knew was, you know, just kind of stupid. Grown men flying around in their underwear, just, it's just kind of pathetic.
I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having us in. Really appreciate it.
Drew and Josh Allen Friedman, their new book of cartoons is called Warts and All. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's joining us from Washington, D.C. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about the growing debate in Congress over the U.S. role in the Persian Gulf and a call from a senior Republican senator for a debate on a motion to declare war against Iraq. Also, in other matters, we'll be hearing about a surgical operation in New York. Not the first time, but a very interesting instance of freezing the patient while an aneurysm is removed. And also a talk with Michael Martin Murphy, who has recorded an album of real cowboy songs, including such favorites as Tumbling Along with the Tumbling Tumbleweeds.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, told the story of Ken Kesey and his friends, known as the Merry Pranksters, as they traveled across country in their old school bus, dropping acid and spreading the hallucinogenic gospel. Now Ken Kesey has written his own version of the story in his book, The Further Inquiry. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
You can see why Ken Kesey might not want to let Tom Wolfe have the last word on the famous psychedelic bus trip of the Merry Pranksters from Berkeley to the Big Apple in the World's Fair, back in 1964. The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Wolf's day-glow secondhand account of this blast-off of the counterculture, just like Radical Chic, his itchy hearsay account of Leonard Bernstein's fundraiser for the Black Panthers, made Wolf look important and everybody else look silly. But this was before anyone had figured out that Wolf was a sort of right-wing Andy Warhol, the world's busiest PR agent for himself, that inside his white suit beats the heart of a Philistine. Now we see him promoting his vanities in Harper's, proving just how many books by other people he's neglected to read. And some of us wish he'd go away in his white suit and sell ice cream. We also hoped Ken Kesey would come down from his Oregon tree and smite the ambulance chaser. But Kesey, who hasn't had a lot to say in the quarter century since One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion, has produced instead a gaudy coffee table book, a box of bonbons, quite as if nobody ever died or went nuts from feeding on the candied fantasies of the era. The Further Inquiry, Further is the name the pranksters gave the bus, is dedicated to, and I quote, casualties from this vector. But you wouldn't know there'd been any from the larky pages of self-praise that follow. What we're supposed to be reading is a screenplay based on the imaginary trial of Neil Cassady on muddled charges of monomania, sexism, escapism, social terrorism, and psychic rape. Cassady drove the bus, as stoned as the rest of them, but a working-class hero to the artists, writers, and college professors. You've met Cassady elsewhere, in various fictions, as Dean Moriarty, or Cody, or Hart. Kerouac especially seemed incapable of writing a novel without him. We also know from Allen Ginsberg's biographer, Barry Miles, that he was crazy and dangerous. Four women killed themselves because of this, quote, macho Irish Catholic wild dude, and he more or less killed himself, stoned again in Mexico. Yet he's acquitted here on all counts, because, well, and I quote again, who can anybody think of that was more interesting? Besides, quote, he was joyous. He could take social and emotional and cosmic changes just like he could take 90-degree turns. Boy, did they have fun, these WASP college kids, miracles of modern chemistry, with their jug of acid-laced orange juice, their cameras and stereos, their white stallions and mandolins, on their way to Timothy Leary, with the ex-king of the beatniks at the wheel. What a blast, even if one of them did flip out and run naked into the goat herds, raving in thorny despair, after which they dumped her in a Houston loony bin. I am looking at color photographs of all of them in Kesey's book, Stark Naked, Zonker, and the Slime Queen. They had no politics except grooving, nor the common sense God gave a tractor. And maybe they even lacked the elemental decencies. A community takes care of its own. If I sound as disapproving as Tom Wolfe, I'm sorry. But I lost a younger brother to too many acid trips and speedball freakouts. He loved One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as much as I did. But he's dead now. And I'm still waiting for an explanation. And this book isn't it.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Further Inquiry by Ken Kesey. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, trumpeter Red Rodney remembers his days on the road with Charlie Parker's band. And we'll hear about growing up Catholic in a mostly Protestant village in Northern Ireland from the Irish writer and literary critic Dennis Donoghue. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.